Again, for those who are just joining us, in the chat, you will have the outline for tonight's Divrei Torah. And my goal tonight is to share a few insights into the Haggadah that you can share at your Seder table. It's going to be an unusual year for many of us, whether we are at our own Seder, with family who are quarantined in our house, whether we are with nobody in our home, whether we're saying the Haggadah by ourselves. It's going to be a very unusual Seder. And my goal is tonight to give you a few things to think about that you can take home and share at your own Seder, either with yourself or with others. The Kollel and Neely are going to be having a few items that are going to be coming out over the next couple of days. Please God, one of the exciting things we're doing for the first time this year is we're creating a community-wide Haggadah in partnership with the CRC that men and women, everybody can drop their own Divrei Torah in, and we'll share that as a community. And in addition, we're going to be having a live pre-Pesach Seder family experience that'll be going on through our MCJL division, which hopefully you'll have a chance to hear about. So let's get started. For those of you who are following the page, it looks like this. We're going to begin with the main section of the Haggadah that we call Magid. Now, the word Magid means to speak, comes from the word Lehagid. Now, that has an interesting connotation, which I never really thought about in the past. Lehagid, it means to tell over, it means to speak. But in a halachic context, it means something very specific. In halachic parlance, lahagid oftentimes is usually in reference to testimony. It's called hagadas edus, the testimony of court. So a person who testifies in court is what we refer to as a magid, somebody who speaks testimony. In what way is the seder hagadas edus? Is it testimony? And I think the truth is that it fits perfectly to use the word magid to be testifying. We are presenting on the night of the Seder testimony to the Jewish story. How David Ben-Gurion, famous Jew, once asked, how many people, and I'm not going to, you could put it on the comments here if anybody knows, how many people know what date the Mayflower sailed from England? Anybody know? Some of you are Googling it under the table. And those who don't have a video on, I can't even tell that you're Googling it. Ben-Gurion once asked, he said, does anybody know what they ate on the Mayflower? No one knows what they ate on the Mayflower, and no one cares. I had to do a search to find out that the Mayflower set sail for the third and final time on September 6th, 1620. Because it's not an issue. Because the story is not personal to most people who live in America. We are Americans, but is that my personal story that a bunch of pilgrims came from England in 1620? It's not my personal story. The night of the Seder is our personal story. So when we come to the table, whether in the presence of others or just by ourselves, by virtue of the fact that we are going to tell this tale again this year, we are giving testimony. This is Haggadas Edus. It is a testimony of the Jewish story that there was a God and he created the world and he rescued us from Egypt and he took us to the promised land and he is with us even today in this terrible crisis, this unprecedented tragedy of the coronavirus that we are struggling with. So I would say that in a certain sense, yes, the Seder is a testimony to the Jewish story. And each one of us, by sitting down and making our own Seder, is testifying to that. And that's why it matters to us what bread the Jews left when they left Egypt. You can ask anybody in the world. You can ask people, who you find on Facebook who are not Jewish, and you ask them, what bread did the Jews eat when they left Egypt? Oh, we ate matzah. They ate flat crackers, and you start the crunching sound, especially this year. I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe we should do the Lincoln Park Zoo can pipe in the sound of crunching matzah to get the full experience for the Gentiles who are going on Chol HaMoed. Unfortunately for them, this year it's going to be great. There's no crunching matzah sounds. Everybody knows that the Jewish story began on the night of the Seder, and therefore it's very important, like any family story, that we have detail and that it be rich. So I think that's one reason, perhaps we can think about why we're going to call this story Magid. Second component, we open the Haggadah with a declaration that is in Aramaic. It's called Halach Ma'anya. This is the poor man's bread, Yachalu Avosanu, that our forefathers ate, Ba'ara de Mitzrayim. And then we say two things. Kol Dichfin, which means anybody who is hungry, Yesei V'yechol, should come and eat. Kol Ditzrich, anybody who needs, Yesei V'yifsach. So what's the difference between Kol Dichfin, anybody who's hungry, and Kol Ditzrich, anybody who needs? Well, the response to somebody who is hungry, Kol Dichfin, we say in the Haggadah is, Yesei, you should come, V'yechol, and eat. We'll give you something to eat. And by the way, that this was said in Babylonia in the times of the Jewish exile in Babylonia, where people spoke Aramaic. Today, people don't speak Aramaic, and they're not showing up at our door. And if they did show up at our door, we're not taking them in because of the coronavirus. So this year, the responsibility for Kol Dichfin Yesei V'yechol is for us to make sure to reach out to the Ark and the Chesed Fund and our local food pantry in advance to make sure that people have matzah. So that we need to do in advance. Kol Dichfin, anybody who's hungry, Yesei V'yechol, you should come and eat. If we already fulfilled that mandate, what does it mean, Kol Ditzrich, anyone who needs, Yesei V'yifsach, experience a Pesach? We experience life in two ways. We experience it on a physical plane, and we experience it on a spiritual plane. When we go through life, sometimes we are physically hungry. So we say to people, Kol Dichfin, if you are physically hungry, come, we'll give you something to eat. We'll make sure to nourish you. But there's more to life than that. Kol Ditzrich, Ditzrich means you feel a need. What is a greater need, a more profound need than just eating dinner? Kol Ditzrich, Yesei V'yichsach, experience a Passover, experience a Pesach, a spiritual experience. What we're telling people is when you get to the meal tonight, yes, there's going to be food. But what we're really offering people is what they need, spiritual nourishment. And I would wonder if today, more than ever, that's what we need. You know, Baruch Hashem, thank God most of us were able to get either food delivered to our home. We're not hungry. We're not dichfin, but you know what we are? We're ditzrich. We are needy. We're needy of companionship. Companionship is a spiritual quality. Feeling together. It's amazing just to feel together, even though I can't see 90% of you. But I know we feel that we're together. That's ditzrich. That's a spiritual, emotional, psychological need. And that is met only with a Pesach, with a spiritual experience. And I would argue even more, the main experience of the Korban Pesach was the revelation of God, feeling close to God, that we weren't lonely on the night of the Seder. And that's what we have this year. Even if you're eating the Pesach Seder alone in your domicile with no one else, but you have the Pesach, you have the feeling that God is passing over us. He's paying attention to us. We're not, no one is going to be alone this Passover. Ditzrich, asking for food. Dichfin, you're asking for food, you can get a food delivery. Ditzrich, you need to create a spiritual environment for the Pesach. That's actually why, for the first time, we're going to do this pre-Pesach experience on Zoom, just so that people who are going to be alone, who want more Yifsach, more Pesach, more spiritual content, they can put that in. And this is something that we should think about when we're preparing for our Seder. We need to prepare that it should be a meal. Yesei V'yechol, people should have something to eat. But we should also make sure that it's a spiritual experience, that we remember that God is part of us. If it's just the hungry part, it's like they once invited, there's an old story in Europe, that there was an observant family who invited a non-religious guest who wasn't really so excited about Judaism, but he heard the Paschal Lamb, they heard the Pesach Seder, it's going to be amazing. So they come to the house, they knock on the door, they say, we'd like to join you for the Seder. So the people say, Gesunte Heit, great, come on in. The guy's thinking, this is going to be amazing. He's going to have the feast of his lifetime. People have been cooking for this. This is like the Jewish Thanksgiving plus, I don't know what. So the guy sits down at the table and the father starts going like this. You know, he starts reading the preparations for the Seder. And then the little kids start chiming in with the songs. And the guy's like, okay, I've been here for about a half hour. And they're still just holding by, you know, oh, they drank one cup of wine. Good. Finish the first cup of wine. Then they start washing their hands again. They're finally going to eat something. The guy says, guess what? We're going to have, you know what we're ready to have? Vegetables and salt water. Meanwhile, the guest is like going out of his mind. Finally, You know, they start the Haggadah 2.5 hours later. The guy is famished. He's ready to start eating the table. And what do they say? Don't worry. It's time for matzah and maror. The guy gets up. He's out of there. He's done. Can't handle it. But that's not the main experience. Yes, there will be food, but the main experience is the Pesach, is the feeling of being together with God. So in the outline, if those who are following in the outline that we dropped in the chat on the side, Maggid is about testifying to the Jewish story. Halach Ma'anya is asking, what do we see? When we look at the bread on Pesach, do we see just food, or do we see bread that has a spiritual story and a connection to the Jewish people? After Halach Ma'anya, we introduce the Manishtana. Now, in some Haggadahs, they have a little paragraph where they say in the Manishtana, Vikan Haben Shoel. And here, the son or the daughter or the spouse or the friend, or you have to ask yourself if you're all by yourself, here the person asks. I think it's interesting, though. I wonder if maybe we could consider the word Shoel in this context from a different vantage point. What is the word shoel? It doesn't just mean to ask. It also means to borrow. In the Talmud, in the Gemara, in Maseches Bava Metzia, there are Arba Shomrim, four people who watch things for you. One is called a Shomer Chinam. I'm going away for Pesach. Can you please watch my dog? Okay, that's a Shomer Chinam. That's somebody who is a free watch person. Shomer Sachar gets paid. So I would say to you, Mishpachas Frank, could you do me a favor? Can you watch my dog? I'll pay you $100. So that's called a Shomer Sachar. You're watching my dog, but you're going to get paid. And therefore, you have a higher threshold of liability. You have to take more responsibility. Then there's the third category. There's somebody called a Socher, a renter. I'd like to borrow your lawnmower. I'm going to rent your lawnmower from you for $50. But then there's the highest level of accountability, and that is the shoel. If I borrow your Chevy Impala, and I drive it, I am taking, according to the halacha, the highest level of responsibility. There are very, very few cases. Only if the thing, you know, if the car conks out the same way that would happen to the owner. Essentially, when you borrow something, you become the owner. A shoel is almost the same level as the owner in terms of responsibility. If you borrow my car, you are going to be darn sure that you're going to return it in the exact same condition, because under almost every circumstance, you're going to be responsible. You take ownership of my car when you borrow it to almost every single extent. Maybe this is the pshat on the night of the Seder, and it's actually very empowering for us when we show up to the Seder. The Seder is structured different than every other mitzvah which reminds us of leaving Egypt. Every morning and every night, we say the Shema. It reminds us of leaving Egypt. My tefillin reminded me of leaving Egypt. So many mitzvahs that we have, tons of mitzvahs, remind us. Shabbos, Yontif, always remind us of leaving Egypt. But that mitzvah of every day is just a quick, remember, we got it done. That's it. How long is the Shema? Quick, in and out. But on the Pesach night, one of the distinguishing features is that it has to be through She'ela u'tshuva. She'ela, asking questions. Why? Because when you ask questions about something, you own it. What we want our children to do when we say V'kan haben shoel, now the child asks, I wonder if Alpidrush we could say, you could tell me this is a bad pshat. I can't see most of your faces. So you might be going like, not so good. It's not pshat. It's a drash. It's a homily. We ask our children and ourselves, V'kan haben shoel. We ask, meaning we take ownership of it. We borrow it. It becomes not somebody else's story. It's not the story of my neighbor or the rabbi. You know, people think the rabbis do this, the rabbis do that. It's not about the rabbis. I ask the question. And that's why it's interesting. The Rambam says, in this year, it's possible that somebody could be alone for the Seder. You know what they have to do? They have to ask themselves the Manishtana. Why? Because when you ask for something, when you borrow it, you own it. You're responsible for it. We become the custodians of the Jewish story. We become the educators of our children, of our grandchildren, of our communities. And even if it's not going to be on Pesach, because we can't be with them, unfortunately, in person, but it's for the entire year. When we say Yetzias Mitzrayim is derech she'ela, it means it is through the mechanism of taking ownership, of becoming a shoel. We're not shomer chinam. You know, it's not that somebody is dropping Judaism in our lap and saying, could you watch it for us for an hour? And we're not even a shomer sachar or a socher, where we pay, you know, umpteen thousands of dollars to educate our kids in Jewish schools. That's not what we are. We are a shoel. We own it. It's our story. It's our narrative. It's our relationship with God. The Kan HaBen Shoel. The Haggadah is all about she'ilot, about the she'ila, the shoel, the borrower, who takes on the level of being the owner. Number four. Any questions, comments, or observations on 1 through 3? You can put it here on the little, what is that thing? Chat. There's a chat button on the side for those who figured it out. I just did. You see on the side, there's a chat. Anybody wants to ask 1, 2, or 3, you can jump in. Let's go to number 4, Manishtana. So Manishtana, I want to think about this here, actually from a Haggadah that I just got. See this Haggadah? I just bought it used online. It's called Abarbanel. The Haggadah called Zevach Pesach. You can get the Hebrew edition of this. I have it here. I wanted the English edition because I thought this is the Hebrew edition. This is really good for screen sharing, right? You can see it perfectly. Love it. Okay, so you're gonna trust me on this. I was a little bit disappointed. I'm not taking anything away from this translation, but the translation does not have the introduction. And that's really what I wanted to bring to your attention tonight, because the Abarbanel has an absolutely fascinating Haggadah, because his life was fascinating. The Abarbanel, he was born in like the greatest of all possible circumstances. He was born in 1437. His father's name was Yehuda. He was a minister of the Portuguese National Treasury. The Abarbanel family traces their dynasty back to David HaMelech. He became a very prominent member of the Lisbon Jewish community, and unfortunately, in 1483, there was some problems in Portugal, so he had to run to Castile. Now, Castile is in northern Spain, not far from Aragon and southern France and Provence. When he became, when he got to Castile, he became one of the major figures in the government, in the treasury department of the King of Spain. So Abarbanel is like at the top, of political and financial influence in all of Spain until 1492. Abarbanel actually intervenes on behalf of the Jewish community, but is unsuccessful in getting the decree rescinded, and he is expelled along with other Jews. He travels in Italy in various places, in Corfu, and Abarbanel basically has his life torn apart. He started when he was younger writing a Pirush on Tanakh, and he finishes that after in all of his Golios and all of his travels. So what's fascinating to me about this Haggadah, which does not appear in the English edition, but appears in the Hebrew edition, the Abarbanel has a Hakdama, has an introduction. And it is amazing, because the Abarbanel in this introduction, and it's, I don't know why he chose this, but every line, if you could see on the paper, just even from afar, on the letter, on the tiny side, you see tiny letters running up and down the page. These letters is kuf yud, ki, or as we would translate in English, whereas this happened. The Abarbanel traces his life story in the Haggadah introduction that he wrote. Fascinating for me, because I'm interested in history. Probably some of you are like, why are you wasting my time? But I think it's interesting, and you'll see why in a second even more. And he says, when I grew up in a house that had wealth and it had honor. He says, Divrei, these are the words of Yitzchak ben, the Sar Adon Yehuda Abarbanel Zatzal, my father, the master, the officer, the minister, Yehuda Abarbanel. And he says, I had a beautiful upbringing and everything was great. And then you know what happened? Everything changed. And he has many lines here, poetic lines, masterful poetry about the destruction that was wrought upon a Spanish Jewish community in the expulsion of 1492. And what had happened to him, how Alai nugz amarti nigzarti. I have received this gzera. I had to travel from place to place. I have become an old man. Zakanti says, I'm old and I have no koyach left. He's krechting over here. He's broken. He has no life, no Jewish community. Everybody's scattered. So what do I do? What do I do? Ravna says, you know what I do? At the end of all this, in the autumn of my life, when things have just, everything has left me, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to offer a sacrifice, a korban to Hashem. To thank God for even all of the tragedies that happened to me, nonetheless, and that nobody could have imagined, says Lo Sarim Arishonim, Mitzukim Midrash, nobody could ever imagine how bad it was going to get for us. And yet, I will offer a Zevach Pesach, a Paschal offering. I'm going to write a Haggadah as my personal sacrifice, a tribute to Hashem. Because what does God want? At the end of the first page in the Akdama, he says, Zivche Elokim Meruach Nishbara, a play on a words in a Pasuk in Tehillim. God wants not animals, but broken hearts, people who want to serve him with devotion. Says the Abarbanel, it's not Zivche Elokim, the offerings for God, Ruach Nishbara. He says it's Meruach Nishbara. It's from a broken spirit. Abarbanel says, I am a broken spirit. You want to know what I want to do with the rest of my life? I want to offer something back to God. To me, it is absolutely amazing. After having undergone everything that he did, he says, I want to offer birchas hodol l'holchei midbarios. That even though I am a desert wanderer, I want to thank God for taking me through this journey, for being with me, for keeping me until now. Absolutely incredible. Even in that dark time. It's part memoir, part halachic work. It's called Alei Meruros. It's not a good Pesach book. It's really a good Tisha B'Av. It's a terrible Holocaust memory written by Rav Yehoshua Moshe Aronson, who was a rabbi in Poland before the war, survived the Holocaust, and ended up in Petach Tikva, where he became a rabbi again after the war in Israel. And Rav Aronson writes what he calls the Megillah, the scroll of his labor in a labor camp. He spent a short period of time in Auschwitz and then a longer period of time in a labor camp called Kunin. He says when he was in Kunin, they actually were there for the Pesach Seder. They scrapped together some food and they got together a group of Jews making a Seder in their barracks. He said they started the Seder, they said Kiddush, and then when they got to Shehechiyanu, he says they just couldn't continue. He said they sat there in the barracks and they just cried their eyes out for a half hour. And he, Rabbi Aronson, said to the people with him, he said, I have a question. How can we say Shehechiyanu? Look at us. We're literally begates almavis in the gates of hell in this work camp under the German occupation, and they're murdering Jews everywhere. How can we say Shehechiyanu? So he said to the people, he says, you know, the Haggadah says, we say the Haggadah, Yemei Chayecha Hayamim, Kol Yemei Chayecha Halelos. We say the Haggadah during the day, and we say it at night. We say it during the day because it's a good time, and we say it at night even when it's a bad time. So what's interesting to me is that that is the message of the Abarbanel as to why he wrote the Haggadah, to say that I am sticking with God even in the bad times, even when my life is broken and shattered, and in my old age I'm wandering from place to place like a refugee, there's still a place for connecting to God. That's the Abarbanel's Haggadah. And that, fascinating, that is how he explains the Manish Tana. He says, if you look in the Abarbanel's Haggadah, here it's in the translation, you can get it online in the Hebrew, he says, all of the Manish Tana actually is one question. One question, which is, why is it that we do things which are contradictory? Why is it that we're doing things that don't jive with each other? On the one hand, you're telling me that it's poor man's bread. On the other hand, you're telling me that it's bread of freedom. On tonight, you're telling me that we eat maror. On the other hand, you're telling me that we're leaning. It's one big question. But I wonder if what the Abarbanel is saying is that that's my question about life. Life can sometimes be a contradiction. It could be that when I was younger, the Abarbanel says, I was living at the top of the world. I was at the top of society. I was the finance minister in all of Spain. And now I'm a refugee with nothing. It's a contradiction. My life is a contradiction. How could it be? And yet, Abarbanel says, at the end of the day, we're going to give Zevach Pesach. It's the presence of God in our life, despite the contradictions. We don't have a great answer. What's the answer to the Manish Tana? We were slaves. God took us out. What does that mean? Abarbanel says, God rescued us once. He's going to rescue us again. Don't worry about the contradictions. They're painful and they're real, but we have to have faith that there is a God and he's going to be with us. Is there a more important message than at this time? We're living with so many contradictions, so much confusion. Where is God? We don't know. Why is God doing this? We don't know. All we know is, like the Abarbanel said, even if we come to the Seder, and unfortunately for many of us, we're not going to be with the family that we're usually with. And it's not going to be perfect. It's going to be a shtickle broken. You know, I'm not going to have my Seder cover that's somewhere and that it's at someone else's house, can't get it. I'm not going to have my, you know, this and that and the other thing. But you know what the Abarbanel says? He didn't have that either. He didn't have it. In 1530, when he's running for his life as an old man, in 1550, I think he died in 1515. He didn't have all those things. And yet he still found the moral inner strength to give a thanks to Hashem for what he has. So the Manish Tana is validating the contradiction that there's slavery and there's freedom and it's happening at the same time, but that's okay. Number 5 on our list. We start mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu va'achshav kervanu amakom lavodaso. We started out as idolaters. Did we ever think for a second? Now, obviously, we understand that it was at a different time and a different place, and there were different spiritual energies, and the force of idolatry took hold, the Talmud says, so strong, we can't even fathom that right now, because the rabbis of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, they prayed that the desire for idolatry should be taken away from us. But maybe there is a way for us to understand this and take a lesson for our lives, and especially for this year. What was so enticing about idolatry? Why was that so enticing? Like, to us, on one level, it's like maddening. Like, you're going to go in your backyard. I mean, it must be in those days Jews were different, because today you tell a Jew to go get a couple of hand tools and make and grave an image, they'd be like, no, I got to hire someone. Hand tools, you know, only somebody who is a convert or a Baal Tshuva or somebody who's very, you know, very handy. I don't know anybody like this, you know, truthfully, who can use a circular saw and a sander. You know what I'm saying? Like, I certainly can't. The only person who's handy in my house is Nechama. I once saw her she was spackling something in our old house in the bathroom. I was like looking at her, like, do you need help? She's like, I use a drill all the time. Thank you very much. So she does all the fix-it work in the house. The regular average Jewish guy, most of us, from birth guys, we can't make idols. But if we could, if we went to Home Depot and we said, could you give us the tutorial on making a wooden idol in aisle 16 with the thick lumber, you know, it's like the guys who are going before Sukkot. That's the best time to be in Home Depot and Passaic. You go to Passaic, Home Depot, Erev Sukkot, and they're asking for help. It's great. So imagine I went to Home Depot and I made an idol. Would that be like appealing, attractive? Like, why would I ever do that and think that that idol is going to help me? So we have to understand how monotheism differs from idolatry. Now, I don't know much about idolatry. I've never practiced as far as I can tell, but I have a teacher, Rabbi Chaim Angel, who once gave an amazing shiur about Migdal Bavel and explained the whole philosophy of idolatry. And in that light, it actually makes perfect sense. In the world of polytheism, of idolatry, there are forces. Those forces all exist within a box, the box of the natural world, the world that exists, the world that we know. And in that box, there are people, that's us, the little small people, and then there are giant forces that are led, managed, personified by gods. And those gods, those forces are warring. So the god of the sun, the force of the sun, is warring with the god of the moon. And this god of the sea is warring with the god of land and the sun god. All the gods are always fighting with each other. And what's our job? Our job is to pacify these gods. And if we pacify them, they'll do what we want. We want rain. So what we do is we offer an offering to the rain god at the top of a ziggurat somewhere. And that will appease the rain god. And that will bring rain for us. We want children, so we offer something to the god of fertility. The assumption here is that it's a system. And what's happening basically is that through polytheism, we, human beings, we control the system. Because we know which levers to pull and push. It's all one fixed box. The gods and we are all in the same system, and we can get what we want if we just navigate it in the right way. Avodah Zarah is predicated in the idea that ultimately we have control. And if that's the approach, it actually makes a lot of sense why that is incredibly appealing. Because don't we always want to feel like we're in control? We want to feel like we're in control. Even when we're actually not in control, we want to feel like we're in control. We want to feel that we have control over the circumstance and the life and the story that is unfolding. But you know what giving up idolatry means? What Avraham Avinu said to these people, Avraham said to them, idiots, there is a force which is beyond this world that is not manipulatable, if there's such a word. You can't manipulate the Ribbono Shel Olam. He is beyond the box. We are all in the box. All of the forces of nature are in the box. But when we believe in God, it's something higher. It's something greater. And you know what we need to do? We need to let go. We need to stop thinking that we control everything. Now, I humbly ask you, and everybody on this call who knows me, and most of you on this call, I see you know me well. No, I don't know much about anything. But let's be honest. Is there anything that we realize more today than we ever did 2 months ago, or that our parents or grandparents maybe even realized? Are we really in control of everything? With technology, we think we control everything. In the world of medicine, in the world of finance, we thought 2 months ago, we thought we control everything. We can manage everything. We got it under control. We got it. We got it. But you know what we learn, and we're learning right now? That we don't got it. We can't control everything. And even when we try to Clorox wipe every box that comes to the outside of our door, and we spray it down, and then we do Libra, and we take a blowtorch to the Amazon man, we still can't control it. We can't. HaKadosh Baruch Hu controls the world. So on the one hand, it's terrifying to let go of the controls. But on the other hand, when we believe in God, on the night of the Seder, we say, Ribbono Shel Olam, you took us out of Egypt. You're going to take us out of this. You're paying attention to us. We don't understand it, but we're with you. You're with us. We're just going to hold on to you for this ride. The truth is, I think that does actually make us feel better. Because thinking that we are in control, if we actually believe that we were in control of everything, and then all of a sudden we found out, heck no, we are not in control of everything. If our lives were polytheistic lives, we would be frantically, you know, worshiping idols, but not getting an answer. When we daven, we're not davening because we believe that we control the universe by davening. What we do is we say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're opening ourselves up to receive the blessing whenever you're ready to give it to us. We know that you know what we need and you're going to give us what's good for us. In the long run, this is what is appropriate for the world. We're telling you that we believe in you irrespective of what happens, good or bad. We say the bracha of Shechianu, we say the bracha lo aleinu of Dayan HaEmes. You see on the news all the time, we need to say Dayan HaEmes. The idea of Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah is that we used to be in a world where we thought we controlled everything through polytheism. And now, V'achshav kervanu hamakom. Now God brought us close. And he says, Kindelach, I'm telling you, I'll let you run the world. You want to play around, Gesundheit, you can start. You can build an internet. I'll give you the insight into how to, you know, manufacture organs. and you can create a society. All those things, Kinderlach, it's good, but at the end of the day, you should know, Kervanu, I'm with you, and it's my world, and ultimately, I'm going to roll it out as I see fit. And so we let go of thinking we control everything through polytheism, and then we get really, we lean in to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the one who controls the world. Number six, Terach. What a strange thing. Yehoshua says to the people, remember where your family comes from. Vayomer Yehoshua Elohim, this is in the paragraph of Mitzchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. We were originally idol worshippers. Who are our forefathers? Ah, the Zeta, Grandpa, do you remember? Grandpa, our idol worshipping Grandpa, Terach. What? Terach, the idol worshipping Zeta? I don't understand. We don't talk about Terach as our grandfather. Avram is our grandfather. Why are we talking about Terach? So my mother-in-law once made a great ta'ara, and it's very appropriate for the Seder, even if our parents or children aren't going to be with us. My mother-in-law pointed out that Terach, he may have been a whacked out guy. He may have been serving every idol under the planet, according to the Medrash. But you know what? Terach was a family man. Terach went with his kids. He went with them to Haran. He was planning to go with Avram, according to the Ramban, to Eretz Canaan. Terach was a family person. Even when it came to Avram and the Kivshan Eish, he probably thought he was doing the right thing from a parenting standpoint. The reason why we bring up Terach at the Seder is because he may have been a terrible Rasha. He may have been a misguided polytheist, but he was a dad. He was a parent. Sometimes we think about ourselves, Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm mamish like the worst of the worst. I can't get it together. I'm not doing the best job. I want to do better. I need to be mechazik myself. I need to do better. I need to be a better parent. I need to be a better friend. Are you a better, are you a worse idol worshiper than Terach? Seriously. Ladies, we might have shortcomings. We're not that bad. We're not. And even Terach, he had something special going for him. And that is that he put his family first. He cared about his family. The night of the Seder, it's a lot about family. And it's to remind ourselves that this is our first and foremost priority. Whatever we do, we shouldn't get down on the fact that maybe we came up short since last Pesach. Maybe the soup didn't come out as delicious because we couldn't get all the ingredients we wanted. Maybe the Haggadah, the Divrei Torah, you know, the rabbi said a bunch of things. It was on a WhatsApp. It was on a Zoom. We forgot it. We didn't print it. We don't know it. You know what? It doesn't matter. Let's make sure that just like Terach gets a shout out in the Haggadah because at least he was a good dad, we should do the same thing. We should just remember that our first priority is to be a parent. Number seven, Rechush Gadol. This is a fascinating observation in the Haggadah. The Gemara also makes a mention of this, that when we got out of Egypt, this is at the end of the paragraph of Baruch Shomer Avtechaso, V'achrei chen yitzu b'rechush gadol. Ah, we should go out with a lot of money. Such a strange thing. Avraham Avinu is told, don't worry, your kids will leave Egypt with a lot of wealth. So much so that the Gemara says that when God was going to take us out, he told the Jews, make sure you get the money from the Egyptians. V'yishalu, you should ask for them. No, please, make sure. Ask them for money. Ask them for the gold and silver. So when you leave Egypt, you're going to be loaded. You're going to be flush with cash. You're going to have beautiful donkeys and, you know, four-cylinder horsepower camels, the whole thing. It's going to be awesome. Why? Why is that important? Could you imagine a bunch of people getting out of servitude? They're just happy to have a sandwich. Why did they need the money? So Rav Cook, in his commentary on the Agadah and the Inaya, has a very interesting observation on this. Explains a lot. It's not so much, there's a Kabbalistic interpretation that Rechush Gadol meant with a lot of spiritual riches. Rav Cook says it's actually practical. Hashem wanted us to leave Egypt with wealth, with money in our pocket. Because, and we are seeing this today, people who are suddenly, or not even just suddenly, people who are impoverished don't always feel good about themselves. One of the stresses that's going on today, you know, I'm a retired rabbi, but many of my friends are professional rabbis. So one of the things that rabbis are dealing with, I was speaking to one of the rabbis in the community today, is that there's a big stress now in many homes about economics. about finances. Finances cause stress. So what Rav Kook says is that when we left Egypt, we had so much psychological damage. We had so much baggage. We had so much building of our sense of self that if we would have left like Shmatas with $5 in our pocket, we would have run out like refugees coming to Ellis Island. You know, we would have come like schleppers, like schnorrers. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no. If we're going to build the Jewish people, not that money is everything, but sometimes when a person has everything that they need financially and then some little bit extra halavai, they carry themselves a little higher. They feel a little better about themselves. They don't have that stress, that anxiety. So it's such a small thing, but it teaches you something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he took us out of Egypt, it wasn't just, all right, you guys are going to die, I'll salvage you. You're going to fall into the 50th, God forbid, impossible level of impurity and be lost forever spiritually. No, that's not just the issue. You know what God worries about? That we should feel like a mensch. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to feel like a mensch. So when the Jews left Egypt, he wanted to make sure they had money in their pocket so that they should feel like a somebody. An amazing idea. What does it mean to live in a time when there's so much uncertainty and there's so many economic challenges and there's so much isolation? Some of the things that we can do before Pesach, just to help somebody feel like a mensch, just to reach out to them and give them a psychological boost. It's not necessarily a financial thing. The finances, says Rav Kook, the finances are an expression of a deeper emotional need that the Jews had. So thinking about that, what is the person's Yetzias Mitzrayim? Today, we are trapped in Meitzarim. Meitzar means a border, a quarantine. We were quarantined in Egypt, now we're quarantined in our house. So how do we get out of Mitzrayim, out of that feeling of trapped, of quarantine? We need to get out of it physically. Halavai, we should get out really soon. Don't try that today. But we need to get out also emotionally. We need to feel like we're in a place where we're safe and secure. Halavai should be financially. That's what we had when we left Egypt with the Rechush Gadol. But whatever it is, we need to make sure that we can create that for ourselves, that we feel good about ourselves and help others feel good about themselves. Number 8, Pesach. The Korban Pesach is very unusual. Usually, sacrifices are focused on the Beis HaMikdash, on the temple in Yerushalayim. There's a very different perspective when it comes to the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach is supposed to be focused on the home. Most korbanos, most sacrifices, if people are impure, even if the entire community is, let's say the entire community is impure, they're tame, all the Kohanim are tame, they could still bring the Korban Pesach. They could do that. That's fine. But it's not so simple because you could bring a general Korban from the community if people are tame, but if you bring a Korban, a sacrifice from the community and everybody's impure, you can't eat it. But not the Korban Pesach. Because the Gemara says the main purpose of the Korban Pesach is to eat it in your house. It's to eat the sacrifice. It's not to offer it to God. Yes, a part of it goes to God in the Beis HaMikdash, but the main focus is on the home. That's why when we were instructed in Egypt to offer the Korban Pesach, it says, Seh lebeis avos, every sheep to the house. Our homes are the main thing. This year, is there a more important theme to talk about than thinking about what does it mean to have God in our house? Do we have, and if we don't have it yet, some of you have heard, I've spoken about this last couple of weeks since we've been buried in our home. So we have a guest room in the basement. We have a space. It's like a little office with a restroom, bathroom next to it. Great, awesome. It now is a shtiebel. One of the kids made a sign. It says, Anshe, welcome to Anshe Motel. Motel was my paternal grandfather's name. My son Arya is named after him. So we decided it's going to be named Anshe Motel, not to be confused with Anshe Matalah. This is the one room in our house where everyone davens, where we have a space designated for a connection with God in our home. We don't have a Beis Knesset. We're not going to shul. So how do we make our home the focal point? Because even in the Beis HaMikdash, in that time, when people went to the Beis HaMikdash, they went to sacrifice the Korban Pesach, but they went home to eat it. And the main mitzvah is the eating. Lo ba mitchila ela l'achila. So do we have a space in our house? It's going to be a 3-day yontif. For a lot of us, that's an awful long time. I don't know how many books you have in your library. I'm inviting anybody who wants to come. I'm giving you just, this is a piece of my special man cave in the basement, or Hashem. So if you want to borrow any books, I can spray them with Lysol and leave them at my front door. You can borrow them. I have, I don't know, maybe a few hundred more, whatever. Whatever you need, I'm happy to lend it to you. Email me afterwards. But even these books, how many books can you learn on 1 3-day Yontif? It's very long. Can we create spaces for God? If you haven't yet, over the 3-day Yontif, maybe have a little corner in the house or the apartment. This is the davening corner. This is the learning corner. This is the place where God's presence is going to rest in your house. If you have children in the house, have them decorated. Put up a little sign. What is the space for God? How do I make my house the bias for the Korban Pesach this holiday? How do I turn it into that designated space where the Korban, the sacrifice, is focused? The place of Korban, Karov, to becoming close to God, it's focused on the house, not the Beis HaMikdash. So the truth is, on the night of the Seder, it's not a big deal that we don't have shul. It is a big deal, but it's not in the sense that the main focus is going to be on the house. All right, we're of course running way over time, as we always do on this night, but we'll try to finish up. And of course, I added number 11 because I couldn't help myself. There were too many things. I'll just do the last three regalachas just so we finish in the next 10 minutes. Anybody who wants to jump off, it's great, no problem. You can be there, you can disappear, I won't even notice. Last 3 points. We did Pesach, now we're going to do matzah. Matzah is something that is very interesting because the whole idea of matzah is that we got out really fast. What does it mean that we got out fast? There was chipazon. So I've seen in Sfarim over the years, Rav Kook talks about this, about when we got out of Egypt, we got out really fast. We were so fast, we were like lamaylam in asman, above time. And I wondered about this. You know, some people say, oh, I wondered about this many years. I don't usually like to say that because I don't usually remember from one day to the next. I don't worry about things for years. I go like breakfast to lunch, lunch to dinner. I can't say I've worried about this question for years, but this question has come to my mind for years, and then I've forgotten about it over dinner, then I remember it years later. What does it mean that because we left in a rush, because we were hurrying, that somehow means we're above time? What does that mean? Because we left Egypt in a hurry, we're above time. We eat matzah because we left in a hurry. So we left in a hurry, azma. So what? Oh, because when we left in a hurry, that meant that we were above time. And then I learned something recently. I read something fascinating. Now, I probably should have known this before. I have to thank my parents for putting me through college. At YU, I took physics for poets. So maybe I got it, maybe I didn't. But I was reading a book called Einstein's God. It's a book, a collection of interviews by Krista Tippett, who is the host of On Being, NPR's faith-based podcast and radio show, which is fascinating. And she has a section there about Einstein and the theory of relativity. So I don't know anything about physics and Einstein, and my professor from YU from my physics days is in the Olam HaEmes by now. I know that for sure. So all I know is what they introduced in this book. And then I went online. I found something fascinating. Einstein says, the whole yesod of the theory of relativity is that time is not fixed. Time is actually relative to the area in which you are found. It's relative to gravity. I didn't know this. That time is different for people who are space shuttle astronauts than it is for people on the ground. If we were really, really, really super sensitive, we would notice there's actually a difference in time between being in the basement and being on the top of the roof. Fascinating. Time is malleable. And they point out in the book, one of the physicists who studies Einstein suggests that maybe Einstein became sensitive to this because he worked in a patent office in Zurich, and the Swiss are obsessed with clocks. Clocks, this physicist points out, are the straitjacket of time. Because clocks make it seem like time is uniform, but it's not. And maybe that's the pshat. Maybe. What do you think? Einstein's theory of relativity explains matzah. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu hastened us out of Egypt, what he was telling us was that we're on Einstein's fast time. And there really is slow time, regular time, and then there's expedited time. And that what God wants us to understand is that time is not fixed. Time depends on our experience. That the spiritual quality of time, it's malleable. And I haven't fully figured out how to formulate this. And maybe you can chomp over it and chew it up when you think about the matzah, chewing your matzah, chewing the time. Like, what does it mean that time is malleable? That time is different in different places in the space versus on the ground? But I think there's something here. And that the chipazon, the movement of time when we left Egypt, that is related to our definition as being, in a certain sense, above time. The speed that we operate at is different than other people. You ever watch Jews talking in the street? You ever see Israelis, how fast they talk? It's mamish above time. But on a regular level, this idea that matzah is hurried, I'm sure it's got to be Einstein was onto something. I mean, it took people who know a lot more than I did to figure out he was onto something, but I think he's onto something having to do with matzah. Last 2 points. Maror. The Gemara says that bola maror, if you took maror, you put it in a capsule and you swallowed it, you weren't yotze. Why not? In theory, you could swallow matzah and be yotze, but not maror. Because there are more than 20 times that it says in the Chumash, remember what it was like to be a slave and think about how you're going to treat other people. How are you going to treat the stranger, the orphan, the servant? You remember what it was like? You had that feeling of what that experience felt like in your own body? How are you going to treat somebody else? We eat maror to remember what it was like to be treated like garbage, to be treated like trash, to eat bitter herbs. You know why? Because now we can understand what it means how to treat somebody else. And you know what we could do today? We could theoretically put that maror in a capsule and swallow it, and we'll never taste the bitterness. So you know what Chazal said? You're not yotze. Because you have to taste the bitterness to be able to treat somebody else nicely. Did you ever see a Holocaust survivor who was beating up somebody else in a rude way without that understanding? Do you ever see a Holocaust survivor who got into an argument about what kind of Jew are you? What kind of Jew are you? It's crazy. What these people went through, there's no more beating others up. There's no more bitterness. It's you're a Jew, I'm a Jew. Amazing. It's because of what they experienced. So Chazal wanted us to eat maror to teach us empathy. And so if you swallow the maror without tasting it, you're not yotze. You didn't fulfill the mitzvah. Because the mitzvah is only if you experience it. Because once you experience that measure of suffering, we understand what that feels like. It creates empathy, how we're going to treat somebody else. And the last point, there was a beautiful drasha in the Sefer called Derech HaMelech. Derech HaMelech was authored by the holy Piasetzner Rebbe, Rav Klonimus Kalman Shapira. Rav Klonimus Kalman, the Piasetzner, before the war, before he became the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, before he was murdered by the Germans in 1943, he gave drashas and Piasetzner to his Talmidim, to his students. And he has a beautiful suggestion. We say, B'chol dor v'dor, chayav adam liras esatzmo. In every generation, it says in the Haggadah, every person needs to see themselves. So I always read this as, in every generation, a person needs to see themselves. B'chol dor v'dor, chayav adam liras esatzmo, ki ilu hu yatsam im Mitzrayim. Like we left Egypt. That's true. But said the Piasetzner of Klonimus Kalman something so beautiful, Al Pidrush. He says, when God went to look for Adam, he said to him, Ayeka, where are you? And you know what? Adam Arishon, Adam, after he ate from that tree, he couldn't answer. He says, I don't even know where I am. I don't know who I am anymore. Says the Piasetzner, B'chol dor v'dor, in every generation and generation, Chayav Adam liros esatzmo. We have to see ourselves. What a beautiful insight. We have to answer, who am I? What am I doing here? What's my job this year? How am I serving Hashem? What kind of a person am I? What kind of a Jew am I? What kind of a child or parent or spouse or friend? Liros esatzmo, to see ourselves, to see myself today in this generation. I wasn't born 200 years ago. Sometimes I feel like I have shaychus like to Europe. I love that. I connect to it. But I wasn't born in Europe. We have indoor plumbing. I'm very grateful I wasn't born in Europe. So what's Liros Esatzma B'chol Dor V'Dor? What is my job this year? What is my avoda connecting to God within a coronavirus pandemic? What is my, who am I today? What is the person that I am able to leave the boundaries, the meitzarim that hold me back, that tie me down? Just Liros Esatzma. Just see ourselves. Who are we today? Make sure that we can answer the question, who am I and what is my job in this world? So to come back to the beginning, we had Magid, we are giving testimony about the Jewish story from David Ben-Gurion. Halach Ma'anya, we see two things. We see physical bread, but we see the opportunity for Pesach of a relationship with God on a spiritual level. Haben Shoel, the children ask, we ask, what are we asking? We are borrowing. We're asking to own the story. Number four, Manashtana, the one big contradiction that the Abarbanel lived with in his life and yet concluded with a Zevach Pesach, with a sacrifice to God. Number five, Ovdei Avodah Zarah, we used to think we could control everything, that there was a pantheistic structure that we can just push the levers and now we just let go and we say, Hashem, we want to be just with you. Terach, we put family first. It doesn't matter how else we failed. Rechush Gadol, we want to make sure that financially, we are a somebody, God says, when we leave Egypt, that teaches us to be sensitive to our psychological makeup. Pesach, the modus, the locus classicus, the focus of the Korban Pesach is in the home. How do we structure our home to be a place of God, this Yom Tov? Matzah, the speed, the chipazon, the quickness of time, the relativity. What does it mean that time is malleable? Maror, swallowing the bitterness so that we can be empathetic, that we can be thinking and feeling the pain of others. And finally, Liros Esatzmo, to be able to answer the question, who am I? Who am I this year? Pesach 5780, we're mamish at the doorsteps of Geula. Please God, he's going to reveal himself. He'll be, there are so many empty 737s, regulars. They got wide body jets. They have 777s, Elal. Everybody's on standby to bring us to Israel. We just need to figure out in our generation, in our day, Liros Esatzmo, who am I today? Take a few moments to meditate on that question, Liros Esatzmo, to just make sure that we are focusing on ourselves, answering that question of who are we, to merit a Chag Kasher V'Sameach.